This is a special Invest Talk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Remember, the Invest Talk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART. 888-99-CHART. They will be played and answered on an upcoming Invest Talk podcast.
We're going to talk to Don from Orinda, California. How you doing, Don?
Hi there. Really well. I have a bond that was just called, and so I now have some money I'm going to need to reinvest in some bonds. And I have another one maturing at the end of July that I'll once again have to deal with having to reinvest it. Would you recommend going with non-callable bonds as I'm trying to replace these, considering rates may be coming down?
Well, if you have bonds that are callable, they can be replaced if rates drop considerably. Now, the bigger question is, will they have the ability to refinance at lower rates? Just because the Fed cuts rates does not necessarily mean that bond rates on the corporate side will fall commensurately. Remember, that's just the short end. And most bond issuance happens at least 4 years out, you know, maybe 3 to 4 in that range, and oftentimes, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years out and beyond. So there's no guarantee that rates on those maturities will fall dramatically, especially if lower Fed funds rate, shall we say, sparks a further decline in the dollar and worries about inflation, et cetera. I could see the yield curve steepening dramatically in that sense. So, you know, I would focus more on, I'd be fine with a callable bond. I don't really have a lot of issues with that because I don't necessarily think that it's going to be something that is a huge risk going forward. Now, it does depend on the name. It depends on what rate it's paying, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if that coupon rate is very high, then yeah, maybe I would avoid a callable note with a high coupon. But if it's around 4 or 5% or so in that range, 6%, I probably wouldn't be too worried about the callable nature of a bond.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much. Question for you also. Do you, as KVP, do you have access to different bonds than we do as consumers?
Yeah, we do. So there are different platforms that aggregate the bonds from institutions and bond demand, right? Sales and purchases. And so not only do we get access to different bonds than the average retailer has access to, but we often get better prices as well. So we use different platforms or multiple platforms that we can and do use. MarketAxess is a good example. It's one. It's a public company, so you can kind of look that at MKTX. So that's where institutions, once again, aggregate purchases and sales, and you get better pricing on those platforms and better opportunities kind of before the average investor gets it. So simple answer to your question is yes. Is it dramatically more? Is it, you know, double, triple, quadruple the size of what the average investor can see? You know, no, not really, but it is considerable.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right. Thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
No problem.
This is Invest Talk, made possible by KPP Financial. InvestTalk listeners and KPP clients alike are invited to take advantage of the many products and services of KPP Financial. For example, the InvestTalk radio program and its podcast replays, the new online training experience, InvestTalk Academy, and the KPP premium newsletter distributed to subscribers each Friday. Learn more anytime at InvestTalk.com. The phone lines are open now, and you can call with your questions. 888-99-CHART.
Hi, this is David at Livermore, California. When you make reference to a certain percentage of your portfolio should be in this or that, do you include the home you live in as part of the portfolio? Do you include retirement accounts and taxable accounts? You know, what all is included in the entire portfolio when you're determining what percentage of that portfolio should be invested in a particular asset? Thank you.
That's a great question. And the reason why it's a good question is because I often talk about thinking about your investments holistic, right? Not just diversifying in your 401k and diversifying in your IRA and diversifying in your brokerage account, but understanding that your investments are the sum total of everything you own within your portfolio. And so really it's just one portfolio with different tax treatments. And so with that in mind, you should look across boundaries and understand the correlations of everything together. And so the question brings in, what about your home? I would say for your primary residence, you can think of it as real estate exposure. But to me, a home, a primary home is a utility. I want to get people away from thinking as of property, their home, their primary residence as an investment, and think of it as utility. Now, if you have investment property, certainly that's part of your real estate exposure. So in short, to make a long answer short, think of your investment portfolio as just that, the assets that you own for investment purposes. It includes your 401k, it includes your IRA, it includes your investment property, your brokerage accounts, everything you use, your CDs, everything. But personally, and again, this is just a personal choice, I think given that your primary home is primarily a utility, I wouldn't necessarily include that as real estate exposure for your investment portfolio. Great question. Thanks for the call.
My question is, I'm 46 years old. I've got a fair amount of stocks, but I've also got a decent amount of credit card debt. And I'm trying to chop away at my credit card debt. Do you think it would be wise to pull out my stocks, pay off my credit card debt, chop up my credit cards, and never use them again, and then start building my portfolio? I know the interest is costing me more than the interest I'm making on most of my stocks. So if you could answer that question, I would be grateful. I hope you have a great day. And again, thank you for the show.
Well, I think you answered the question for yourself. You said that the interest that it's costing you towards these cards is more than what you're making in the market. And that's because credit card debt in particular can create a stranglehold on your finances. And that's because the interest rates are so astronomically high. Generally speaking, when you're thinking about the debt picture in terms of, do I want to pay this off? Do I want to pay it off over time? Credit cards are always, unless it's an introductory offer or something that's particularly low, one of those things you should pay off. It can be in the 20%, the 30%. But generally, the math comes down to, can you make more investing elsewhere than paying this off early? Here's the example. Say you have an auto loan. Say you have a mortgage. Say you're lucky enough to have one of those 3% mortgages. If you have the money to pay that all off today, should you do it? Or should you invest it? You could put it in ESCF. You put it in a money market fund. You can make more than that 3%. And so you'd put the money in the money market fund. You'd make your 4.5%. You'd do the monthly payments. At the end of the day, you'd end up with positive money compared to just paying it off right then and there. That's not the case with credit cards. So what you should do is do all you can to pay off those credit cards. Then once you're in a position where the debt is not accumulating greater than the returns you're getting in the market, start to put money back in the market. Thanks for the call.
You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. Get ready for an all-new InvestTalk Wealth Webinar, Beyond the Mag 7. How to identify AI opportunities across sectors. Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero are going to help you move past the familiar names to identify the key opportunities for investment in the real AI revolution. They'll be talking about the energy grid, data center infrastructure, and how AI is boosting profits in a wide range of industries. The all-new InvestTalk Wealth Webinar, happening online September 30th from 1 to 2 p.m. Pacific Time. Seats are limited, so register now at investtalk.com. There's value in every InvestTalk podcast, so call InvestTalk 888-99-CHART.
This is a special InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Remember,
The InvestTalk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART.
It's Nick from Washington, D.C. I have a real estate question for you guys. Con in regards to a cooperative or a co-op, the unit I'm currently renting isn't a co-op, and I've been thinking about buying a unit in my building. I don't know what a cooperative is versus owning the property outright. I've been reading it online, still can't fully grasp it. You guys are great at breaking down these topics. I was wondering if you could help me out understand this. Thank you very much. Have a good one now, guys. Bye.
All right, well, co-ops are common in bigger cities where, you know, prices are high, and there's more ability to kind of create this communal relationship between those that really buy into a co-op. And, you know, you're not really buying into it. You're really buying a share in a nonprofit corporation that owns the building. And, you know, you receive stock instead of title, like you will with a traditional home purchase. And it makes it unique, okay, but it's very different. I wouldn't think of it as really an asset. It's not going to be worth as much. Obviously, you don't have as much say as you do with your own property, right? You're going into it with a bunch of other people, and, you know, they have their own rules, and you may agree with that or you may not. You have to look at the bylaws, you know, these people that you really want to tie yourself to in a living situation. And so that's the way I would think of it. Don't think of it as really a piece of real estate, because once again, you can't just do whatever you want with it like you can with most real estate. So could work for you if that's from a lifestyle perspective, what you want. You know, do you want that community? Do you want the lower cost that it comes with buying into a co-op? Or do you want more complete control? Thanks for the call.
Have you heard about the new InvestTalk store? That's right. You'll find great merch for the savvy investor. It's all there for you now at InvestTalkStore.com.
I was calling because I had a couple questions real quick. I just have a daughter not too long ago, and I also have a 2-year-old. Or at least open up an account for them and start investing for them. And with that said, though, I'm wondering what kind of account would be best for them, especially in this market right now. I just want to get you guys' opinion on that, and I appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Well, first and foremost, congratulations on your new baby. And it is great that you are thinking about how best to start saving for them. And so you got a couple options here, right? You got a 529 plan. 529 plans can help you save for education expenses. They offer tax-free growth and withdrawals as long as it's a qualified expense. You can have a UGMA or UTMA, which is an account for a minor, with flexible savings that you can get, your child can get access to when they reach a certain age. If your kid goes into modeling, like child acting, something like that, if they have earned income is what I'm getting at, then you could open up a Roth account for them, but only if they have earned income. But if I was going to start somewhere, you got to start at the 529. It has so many tax benefits, not just the tax deferred or the tax-free growth, but tax-free withdrawals as well. And so start there. If you max it out, maybe start to open up one of those more flexible accounts.
Question about investing in bonds right now. I have a mixed portfolio with about 30% in bonds. And my question is, how should I look at bonds right now with the sort of current interest rate and inflation environment? And what's the benefits versus cons of shifting more to equities? Thanks very much.
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think the first thing that's important to know is how old you are, right? If you're further along in your life cycle, then you do want to hold more bonds because you're preserving that capital, you need income, you're going to spend it down. Now, in terms of this current market environment, you're seeing it with government yields. You're seeing it with the 10 and 30 year yields rising. The bond market, bond vigilantes, the market is pricing in the likelihood, the potential, maybe not the likelihood after this week, but the potential for a blowout in fiscal deficits, meaning the cost of financing the debt of the United States goes up. If the benchmark rate goes up, everything else goes up. And so although we're talking about the potential for a Fed rate cut this year, you still have to understand what the long end looks like. And if the long end gets blown out, you want to stay short on the curve. Because with bonds, a bond's price is going to go down, a current bond. Price is going to go down if rates go up. Why? Because you can get new on-the-run issues at higher rates. Conversely, if rates go down, the current bond's price is going to go up because the new issued bonds have lower interest rates. Now, if we're talking over a long investment horizon, because you said, when would you want to invest in equities? It's really if you have that long investment horizon. There are periods, 1-3 year periods, where you do see bonds outperform equities. Pull back though, 5-10-15 year periods, nearly every time equities outperform. So it's a risk return thing. It's an investment horizon thing. And it's a what stage in your life you are thing. Thanks for calling. That is a great question about bonds.
You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
Let's go talk to Dave in Fremont, and he wants to talk about investing in the country of Morocco. Dave,
yes, hi. Really enjoy your show. Thanks for all you do.
Appreciate it.
Just a quick question. Yeah, I've heard that there are a lot of companies doing a lot of moving and growing companies in Morocco right now, and that Morocco could possibly be, you know, like the big West Coast of America, how California has blossomed. A lot of stuff is growing right now and happening in Morocco, and I'm curious, what's a good way to get in and invest into a whole new country of growth, and how to get in, how to get my money into something that would grow, maybe like an S&P of Morocco, or I really don't know anything about investing in foreign countries. So do you have any advice about that? Thank you.
Well, no problem. Thanks for the call. Now, that is a challenge because Morocco is such an emerging market, a very small country. And you know, I've heard great things. It's actually on my list to go visit. And so I agree with that, to find ways to get exposure to countries like or get exposure to Morocco. There's no real I don't know of any ETF or anything like that. I'd have to dig in. There's probably some foreign companies that are listed on other exchanges that you might be able to purchase. And you can go do that through your broker, buy those foreign entities. But I don't know any off the top of my head. There's ETFs like the VanEck Africa ETF. I'm not seeing any exposure to Morocco, though, in this. As I can see in Morningstar what countries it's exposed to, but it's mainly South Africa. Actually, it has some UK, Canada, Australia. Those are the main exposures. So I don't see a direct exposure trading on domestic markets. So I would have to just do a deep dive, and I've never done that for Morocco, but I would encourage you to do it. Thanks for the call. I love those questions. Unique. Those are some of the plays that can be the most rewarding because there's not really money allocated there. If you're early on in that, and that becomes a common theme of investing in Morocco, and you know, it's kind of the in the Mediterranean, on the north coast of Africa, and could be a great investment. But thanks for the insights.
Looks like we got plenty of time to at least play another question, so let's tackle this one now.
And this is Mike from Tracy. How do you guys determine a value stock? And does the value stock change in different economic conditions? Great show, avid listener, and I greatly appreciate you guys. Have a great day, and look forward to hearing your answer. Bye.
Great question, because people throw around words like value and growth all the time. And value means that you are paying less for the company on a relative basis. It's a relative price calculation. Now, in the empirical research, if you go back to Fama French with the 3-factor model and the 5-factor model, what they did is what is called a regression, based on characteristics of companies. And so they sorted them based on their value characteristics. What they used was price to book. And so this is called a relative price calculation, the price that somebody is paying in the market, right? It's price on the stock exchange, relative to its book value, the value of its assets. If a company has a lower ratio of what people are paying versus what it has, its assets, well, that's a value name. If it's higher, well, that is a growth name. The reason why is because growth companies, your tech companies, tend to have the potential for high profits in the future, whereas those value companies are more established now. Now, we use price to book. We use enterprise value to EBITDA. We use all sorts of calculations. We even use some that include cash flow, which tends to bleed into profitability, but that's a different question. But the main point here is that generally speaking, what that research found and what subsequent research has found is that it doesn't really matter what multiple you're using. If it's a market price to company specific multiple to judge relative price, you get generally the same type of answer. The usefulness of them tend to be different from a trading perspective. But the key here is that when we talk about value, we're talking about relative price. How much am I paying for what I'm getting? Thanks for the great question.
Let's go with another YouTube question. Daniel says, what's the difference between a 403b and a regular 401k? Well, put simply, a 403b is typically in relation to some sort of nonprofit, okay? Some sort of, so 501c3 nonprofit, or some sort of public school, for example. So if you're a teacher, you probably have a 403B. If you work for some sort of nonprofit, tax-exempt organization, you also will have a 403B. But from church, right? You work for a church, for example, public college, university, high school, et cetera. And their rules are largely very similar to a 401K. They're just not run by a for-profit institution. You do the same thing with a 401k as you do with a 403b. From an investment standpoint, you know, there's usually a set of investment options. You can roll that into an IRA once you leave that job, and no tax consequences, etc. Some of them have Roth options, I believe, 403bs, but some of them don't as well. But for all intents and purposes, they're the same. It's just who's the employer.
This is an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
This is a special InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Remember, the InvestTalk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART.
Let's touch a bit on the consumer, and more specifically, the young consumer. Now, in-store and online purchases for 18 to 24-year-olds, so they're very young, right? In college, just out of college, it fell 13% year over year between January and April, while spending by older cohorts continued to rise. And it's really about, there's two factors here. One is, it's very difficult to find a job out of college right now. It's a microcosm of what's happening in the economy. I said this. Companies are not laying off a lot, but the vast majority out there are either very hesitant to hire, or on a complete hiring freeze because of the lack of clarity in the business community, in the broader markets. They don't, not only maybe they'd be directly impacted by tariffs, but almost every business is at least indirectly impacted by tariffs. Okay. And so that uncertainty is causing a lot of companies to just not hire. And that's why you're seeing the continuing unemployment claims just continue to rise. And all the hard data, once again, is looking pretty negative. So it's harder for them to get a job. And then student loan payments are also restricting millions of borrowers. Used to be they were on forbearance. And now, as of just a few months ago, they have to pay. Instead of money going into the economy, it's going to repay these loans. Now, credit card delinquencies have risen to the highest point since before the pandemic and are at the highest for 18 to 29-year-olds. Okay. Now, where have they stopped spending? According to Wells Fargo, categories that have fallen the most, apparel, 11%, accessories, 18%, technology, 14%. That's interesting, you know, cutting digital services like Netflix, et cetera. And then small appliances, 18%. And Bank of America found that for Gen Z and millennials, so you're talking about those that are in their 20s, 30s, and all the way into early 40s, because millennials go into the early 40s. Between May of 2023 and May of 2025, they're down 1%. Think about that. Think about where the equity markets have gone, asset prices, home prices, etc. It's not benefiting that cohort. And I think this is also kind of accelerating the political divide in the country as well. Because those younger people, generally, they're the ones that are spending more each year, not less. It's usually the older generation, those that are in retirement. They're the ones that are spending less because their health often doesn't allow them to travel more or, you know, move a lot, right? Most people, when they hit 60, 70 years old, they slow down a little bit. They don't travel as much. They definitely don't move. They don't buy new furniture, not as much, at least, as younger people who are forming homes, right? Buying new homes, moving into new apartments, you know, traveling with their friends, going to concerts and shows, things like that, things that a lot of younger people tend to do. But those people, over a two-year period, actually had negative growth in their spending. Pretty amazing. Online sales and accessories, like I said, down dramatically. Certain companies are seeing 30% drops in the first 3 weeks of June. So it's accelerating in this month as well. And there, a lot of them are trading down. So they may be buying, still buying, but they're buying the cheapest as opposed to something that might have been better and more expensive. One thing they're spending more money on, though, which is interesting, is a lot of people are coming in, especially women, that are trying to do more things at home, right? Dye their hair, do their nails, etc., and trying to save money that way. And then they mess up and they go to a professional to fix it. So that's what's actually been picking up. But the point here is that in general, the system is not working for that cohort. So it's very important to understand that from a long-term perspective, from a political and social cohesion standpoint. And if you're wondering what's going on with the younger generation, it's showing up in the labor statistics, it's showing up in the spending statistics, and it's something I think we all need to think about.
All right, let's roll another question in now, this one on mid or small cap stocks.
Hello, it's Jordan from Minnesota. I'm just wondering, in today's market environment, if you'd recommend investing in large cap, mid cap, or small cap stocks, or if you'd kind of do a mix of all three. Thanks. Appreciate everything you do.
Large, mid, and small cap stocks. So we're covering the whole shebang here, if you will. And so I think this question is there's two different answers here. Historically speaking, small companies tend to outperform mid-cap companies that tend to outperform large-cap companies. Why? It's because investors tend to demand more return for higher risk, and smaller names are riskier than larger names. I like to give the example that if I go out to take a loan, Warren Buffett goes out to take a loan, I'm probably going to get a higher interest rate, I imagine, or the person who's underwriting the loan is not doing their job. Now, that means that if you have a long investment horizon, times where maybe in the short term, small caps are underperforming, they're more negative than large caps, can be for somebody who's investing for a decade or beyond, a great time to pick it up. But in this type of environment where interest costs are rising, yields are trending upward, though they are down today on the back of the potential for the big, beautiful bill not to pass. In an environment where capital is more expensive, where money isn't free, large caps do tend to do a little bit better. And so if you're thinking about the short term, I would be more tilted towards large caps. It doesn't mean not be invested in small and mid caps, but it means understand how the market dynamics are affecting things in the three different time frames over which we invest: short, medium, and long. Either way, the best type of strategy is a well-diversified strategy.
Have you heard about the new InvestTalk store?
That's right. You'll find great merch for the savvy investor. It's all there for you now at InvestTalkStore.com.
I have a question. For a Roth IRA, I know after the 5 years of having the account open, you can go ahead and withdraw your actual investment. But I was wondering if you have dividend stocks within that profile, when you receive those dividends after 5 years, can you also withdraw those? Thank you.
No, it's only the contributions to your Roth IRA. Remember, dividends are part of the return profile of equity investments. It's not just capital appreciation, it's dividends as well. And so just because they're paying you a dividend doesn't mean that doesn't count as a contribution. So Roth IRAs are become more popular. I think that's great because of that kind of rainy day fund that it's easy to make them into after 5 years. And you can go and take that money, still invest it while you're waiting and living your life. And if anything bad happens, you can go and take that money out. And so that's a great thing, a great feature of Roth IRAs. But no, the dividends do not count as contributions, and that's not part of what you can take out tax and penalty free.
It's like we have our first live call of the day, Art from San Jose. How can we help you?
Hello, this is Art Wagner. I'd like to ask a question pertaining to preferred dividend stocks. I'm looking at something put out by Wells Fargo called WFC.PR.D, and I understand that you buy a share and it's part of a large depository set of shares, and the interest rate is yield is 6.35%. I know you don't like high yield, and I'm wondering, what is your comment on this kind of purchase?
Don't mistake chasing yield with purchasing a yielding security, right? And so when we say don't chase yield, we mean if you're looking at the common stock market and you're seeing a company that has 11, 12% yield, it could be because the price has fallen a lot. That's not the case with preferred shares and preferred dividend shares. These are instruments that you're purchasing that don't really see much price appreciation at all, if any, that are far less liquid, whose sole purpose is to provide you with dividends and income. And so they can be good sources of income for somebody who is needing that in their portfolio. I don't have much detail on this specific preferred dividend, but generally speaking, preferred dividends, preferred shares are for income investors. Don't expect capital appreciation. Expect lower liquidity as well. Sometimes you're even locked in, but don't confuse that with chasing yield. This is investing for yield, not chasing yield. Thanks for the call.
On radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com.
My question today is about H&E Equipment Services, Inc.
And for our podcast subscribers.
If you're willing to take the risk.
InvestTalk.
If you're okay with that risk.
With host and financial advisor Justin Klein.
And that volatility. Go for it.
And co-host and portfolio manager Luke Guerrero.
This company has fallen like a rock. It's down 52%.
InvestTalk.
Ticker symbol THT.
Everybody wants a secure financial future.
Richard, you have a question about TOL?
But getting there takes strategy, discipline, and the right information.
Wonder what you think of the price of it.
Go to Chris in Maine looking at IEX.
Hey, Justin. I own it. Just seeing what you thought of it.
InvestTalk is made better by listener contributions. So don't forget to call 888-99-CHART.
Hey, InvestTalk. This is Stephen from Orange, California, a 10-year listener, and I really, really enjoy the show and have gained so much information from listening over the years. I wanted to ask a question today as to why the Dow Index is used so often in referring to the general day-to-day movement of the market. I would think the S&P 500 and NASDAQ would be a more appropriate gauge of what's actually happening in the market based on more companies. If you have any insight into that, I'd love to hear your answer on the show. Thanks again. Bye.
Yeah, I agree. I think you never hear me talk about the Dow. The Dow it's been around longer than the S&P, so it does have that history, but it's only 30 names. It's price weighted. It's not market cap weighted. So, you know, if a company has a split, it lowers the weighting within that index. So that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because a stock split has no relevancy to the value of the business. So I think the main reason it's used is, number one, that history being around longer than the S&P. but also the large number. And so when there's a market move, you know, 1,000 points on the Dow used to be a huge market move. Now 1,000 points, that's only about 2.5%. That's not that crazy. But when it comes to the news, right, especially your non-financial news outlets, it just sounds better to say the Dow was up or down 1,000 points versus the S&P was up or down 100 points or 300 points, right? So 300 points on the S&P is pretty big. That's about, right, 5%. But 300 points on the Dow is minimal. Okay, 300 points on the S&P is much bigger move than 1,000 points on the Dow. It's about double. So to me, that's the reason. It just sounds cooler, sounds more interesting, sounds like it has more impact. Now, I also think the NASDAQ is probably not a good gauge either. It's better. There's 100 names, but it's not the Dow. It's not the S&P, excuse me, where it's 500 names. I would even go further than that. I like even broader indices. I like things like the Russell 3000, which is the 3000 largest names. So now you're talking six times the size of the S&P. You have things like the NYSE Composite Index. That's been around a very long time as well. That's about 2,500 names. So I think there's even improvements beyond just the S&P. But overall, I'm not sure why they still use it. I know we don't use it. We never look at it. We look at mainly NASDAQ, S&P, NYSE, Russell 3000, Russell 2000, Russell 1000, things like that. Those are the ones that we tend to look at to get kind of a broad view of what's happening in the market.
You've got two for the price of one. Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero are here, and they're taking your finance and investment questions now. 888-99-CHART.
Looks like we have a live call. Let's go to Tirth in San Jose. You have a question about your 401k?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I recently changed my job, and I have 401k with my old employer, which I want to roll over. So I wanted to get information, like, what would be a better option between, like, traditional IRA or Roth IRA? And, like, I'm also happy to answer, like, any relevant information from my side which can help with this decision. So, like, I'm 30. I don't need that money for, like, long, long time. I do expect to get in, like, higher tax brackets as I move forward in my career. But, yeah, and I have, like, 5 years' worth of, like, 401k amount in my, like, old account.
Okay, yeah. So the first thing I would do is I would want to roll it over into a traditional IRA probably nearly immediately. And the reason why is because when you keep something in a 401k account, you could be paying a plan fee, right? Sometimes companies swallow those fees, sometimes they don't swallow those fees, but they tend to be more expensive and your options tend to be far more limited. Now, if you wanted to do a Roth conversion, you don't have to convert to the full amount all at once, right? And so one of the strategies for converting from a traditional IRA into a Roth IRA is to only do it as much each year such that you don't push yourself into a higher tax bracket. And so as we just mentioned, you know, to a previous question, the key here is about minimizing the amount of taxes that you are paying. Mm-hmm. And so for some people, it also makes sense to just keep it in a traditional IRA because they aren't going to be earning any income in retirement. And so they're going to be in a far lower tax bracket. And so, you know, this is a question that is very person specific that you would likely be best advised to consult with a tax professional who can look at your full situation and give you some options. It's something we do for our clients at KPP, but we need to see all of their information in front of us. And then we have tools that help us decide the amount and whether or not we're going to delay or do it all immediately. But the first thing I think you want to do is get it out of that 401k into a traditional IRA, give you more investment options, and save you some money potentially from those plan fees.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
This is an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
This is Ray from Illinois. Very much appreciate the podcast and everything you teach your listeners. I have a question about fractional shares. A lot of the online brokers are advertising fractional shares. And I was wondering, from your standpoint, is there a downside in buying fractional shares versus whole shares? Just thinking in terms of investing in round dollar amounts as opposed to specific number of shares when buying and selling stocks. If you could let me know, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Put simply, no, there's not really any downside unless there's some additional costs for the broker. I haven't seen that. I don't see that. I think that's just a feature they've rolled out where you can buy fractional shares. Now, I don't know how they do that kind of behind the scenes, but yeah, I think it's a great way to gain exposure to companies that, especially if you don't have a small dollar amount and you can't afford, you know, from a, especially from a diversification standpoint. It used to be, oh, if it's a $10,000 account and I go buy a company that's trading for $1,000 per share, and there's plenty out there, and a lot of them are cheap, even though they look $1,000 per share. You might sound that sounds like a lot, but remember, it's always in relation to earnings and cash flows, et cetera. So, you know, they have to buy one share and that might be 10% of the portfolio, and that might be too much. Now you can buy fractional shares, buy 0.1% of a share, and now that's only $100. Now it's reasonable as a percentage of the overall portfolio. So I think it's great. I think it's outside of free trades, it's probably the next best thing the brokerage community has rolled out over the last, you know, 5-10 years or so, is the ability to buy fractional shares. I've see no downside to it, at least from my point of view. And it's a good way to kind of accumulate shares of companies you might like and not have to worry about it getting becoming too much of your portfolio. So great question, and hope that helps.
Got a question for Justin or Luke? You're the best person to ask it.
Is it a good idea to sell your losses in a Roth IRA and just use whatever you have left to reinvest into better stocks?
InvestTalk is ready 24/7.
I would really appreciate if you could give me an entry point for a company called Medtronic, MDT.
Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART, or post your questions on the InvestTalk YouTube channel.
Now, from time to time, we receive InvestTalk questions over there on our YouTube channel in the comment section of any one of our many videos that we put out for you on a daily basis. And this one was from Nicholas Collins 4260. It says, what are your thoughts on the growth to value trade? I was wondering what your thoughts were on the growth to value trade. The charts show that growth stocks outperform value stocks more drastically, I think that's supposed to say, in recent decades than they used to. Is this something that is most likely to continue? And if so, which index would be better to invest in the short to medium term? Okay, so historically speaking, if you go back to the 1920s, which is all the available data we have, empirically you see an outperformance of value relative to growth. Why is that? Well, it's a sensibility perspective, right? If you think about a stock's return, its expected returns as the demand investors have for taking on excess risk, and you consider two companies that are exactly the same, their prices are the same, but one of them has higher book value, well, then in order to make that equation equal, the discount rate has to be higher for the one that has a lower relative price. And so that's a lot of finance mumbo jumbo I just threw at you. But essentially, companies that are trading at a lower valuation relative to what their assets are historically have outperformed. Now, that hasn't been the case in the past decade. And if you want to dive into this, we actually did a webinar on this years ago. It's on YouTube. But that hasn't really been the case. And one of the reasons why, it could be askew from a couple tech companies that have done really well, a shift in the U.S. economy towards those services sectors, towards those technology companies, or it could be indicative of zero interest rate phenomenon that really hasn't happened for as long a period as it did in the 2010s. Now, you've started to see some of a reversal there a little bit, but I haven't been fully convinced that the economic sensibility perspective of what is going on, why inherently it makes sense that value securities outperform, I don't think that's really broken down in a way. Now, you can judge value versus growth in many, many ways. The research, the Fama French research, did it on price to book. The reason why they did that is because it tends to be more stable over time. If book value only changes once a quarter, well, then you're not really having a lot of turnover in your portfolio. But you can look at price to cash flow, enterprise value to EBITDA. You can look at all sorts of valuations that, again, over the long sample, tell you that value has still outperformed. And so going forward, if you're looking on a long basis, I'm still not seeing anything that suggests that the market has broken down in such a way that what drives asset prices has changed. So for me, being a value investor is still a good side of the trade to be on.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.